Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. Energy fuels our lives in ways that seem magical. Energy turns darkness into light, cold into warmth, water into ice. But of course, that's all physics, not magic. But energy is kind of like magic if you think about the rules.
Magic is organizing chaos.
This is from the Netflix series The Witcher.
There is no conjuring something from nothing. There is a give and a take.
The same is true for energy.
You never create or destroy energy. You only convert it from one form to another.
That's Clifford Johnson. He's a professor in the physics and astronomy department at the University of Southern California.
There's a fundamental law. Perhaps one of the most fundamental laws in physics is what's called conservation of energy, which is precisely this idea that it changes from one form to another, but you never really destroy it or create it.
Let's say you want to make a cup of tea, you turn on the stove, and energy is released.
It's either the chemical energy that's stored in the gas that you're going to then burn, or it's the electrical energy coming in through the wires.
The energy from the stove converts as the water heats up.
The temperature of the water represents how much energy every individual water particle has. And what they're doing is they're really just jiggling around. And you're making them jiggle more when you raise the temperature.
You pour the water into the teapot. It warms up the pot, the air around it, the table it's on.
Energy is slowly leaking out everywhere. But most of what you want and where you want it to be is in the hot tea.
When that energy dissipates, doesn't it disappear? Like when the tea cools down and the air cools down and I cool down and everybody cools back down, isn't that gone then?
So it's the difference between being gone and being inaccessible, unusable, not maybe useful anymore, not retrievable. And so that's the difference. Energy is always being converted in this long process, this everyday process, into different forms or being distributed in different ways. And if we were to carefully measure all the different forms of energy that began with that turning on that stove, it would all add up to that energy that we used.
So as you were talking, I was thinking, if I were in a completely sealed room, and inside of that room is a ball pit, like you have at McDonald's or at IKEA, I can throw those balls around any which way I want, but the amount of balls in the room, like I can take them out of the ball pit or put them somewhere else or this or that, but the amount of the balls in the room will never change.
Yes, that's a beautiful analogy, in fact, yes. And you could push the analogy a little bit further and say, well, those ball pits usually have balls of many, many different colors and things like that. And so you could say those are the different forms of energy, but the total number of balls doesn't change.
On today's episode, we explore this ball pit we're playing in and the ways we've tried to innovate within these limitations. New ways to convert energy from one form into another, to store it and save it. Even though we know that energy can't be created, there's always been that dream. Could we defy these laws of physics? Get something for nothing?
Maybe I could just sort of magically create some energy from nowhere.
The closest thing we have to a magical power source is the sun. It sits out there in space and sends out a constant stream of energy. But Clifford says even the sun doesn't create energy from nothing. All that energy comes from a process called nuclear fusion. It releases stored energy, like with other energy sources.
At the chemical level, when you look at the fire burning, what are you doing when you burn that coal or that wood? You're actually releasing energy that's stored in chemical bonds. You set it going, you light a match or what have you, set it going, and so then a chemical reaction starts.
You need some power to get it going.
But then the whole process unleashes stored energy in the chemical bond, so you get more out.
Fusion gets to that stored energy by fusing atoms together.
What you're doing is you're taking two kinds of nuclei, and you push them into each other, and they form a new nucleus. They bind together. They fuse. That's where the word fusion comes from. And it turns out that when you form the new thing, there's energy left over. When you change from the two separate ones to the one new one, when they bind together, they give up what's called the binding energy. It doesn't mean that you've created energy. It's just that it's a mechanism of release. So how much do you put in to get the whole thing going? And then once it gets going, the magic happens. It's not magic, it's science. but out comes that stored energy. And the marvelous thing about nuclear fusion is that you can release a lot of energy in a small amount of matter.
But replicating what the sun does here on Earth is very difficult.
The problem is pushing these things together. So that's the match in this case. And you actually need some initial energy because these things want to repel each other. You need to some extra energy to push them together. And that's the whole problem with fusion. You need to find ways of squeezing these things together and confining them in a controlled way. And also the whole thing then gets very, very dangerous in the sense that it is these things in their pure form, if they touched anything in that process, would sort of destroy it. So you need a way of holding it all together. So you need what's called a containment system.
The matter that system has to contain is plasma.
So you have this fluid or gas of charged particles, which is an inherently volatile thing because that charge, it wants to balance out that charge. So if it comes into contact with other things, it's going to be trying to strip the charge off those things. And also it's quite hot because you want it to be at high temperature so that these nuclei bump into each other and fuse.
Fusion has been a bit of a scientific unicorn chase that's been going on for decades. But there's one project that claims to be finally getting closer to harnessing that sun-like energy. Reporter Grant Hill looked into it.
Nuclear physicist Mark Henderson says if we wanted it badly enough, fusion power could be ready for prime time in just 20 years.
If we put the money, we put the effort, and we put the ingenuity behind it.
It being a functional nuclear fusion energy reactor that could produce usable electricity.
But we would have to be committed to doing that. And governments would have to be committed to putting the success of fusion first.
He hopes the project he's been working on for the last dozen years will give fusion power that push.
ITER will be the world's largest experimental facility to demonstrate the scientific and technical feasibility of fusion power.
ITER stands for International Thermonuclear Experimental Reactor. It's often called the world's largest science experiment and the next step in our journey to fusion energy.
ITER is the Latin word for the way.
Well, the way.
The way.
Still under construction in the south of France, the huge donut-shaped fusion test reactor is a product of diplomacy. In the 1980s, two longtime foes, the US and USSR, came together with a common mission to harness the seemingly magical power source for something other than mutual annihilation. It didn't take long for other countries to join, and in 2001, the final design for the project was approved. All in all, 35 countries are splitting the cost of ITER. The final price tag is still up for debate. If you ask ITER, the bill will run around $25 billion. The U.S. Department of Energy puts it at nearly $65 billion. But who really cares about all that public money when the payoff is proof that virtually unlimited energy is actually feasible, right? A sun in a bottle we can tap whenever we need it.
Fusion is a practical source of energy, and that fusion would be commercially viable. That's what we were promised.
Well, Stephen Krivet, a science writer and private investigator, is here to rain on our stellar keg stand.
Even though there are many interesting things to learn about fusion research, the only thing that really matters to people, the only thing that really matters to the world, is whether fusion can be a source of energy. That means whatever power you need to put into the reactor device to make it operate, you have to get out a lot more power than the power that you put into the machine to make it work. If the output rate isn't a lot higher than the input rate, it's maybe scientifically curious, but it's practically useless.
Stephen is not a formally trained physicist like Mark. He doesn't have a degree in nuclear anything. But a couple of decades ago, Stephen got really into fusion energy. So he just started showing up at random conferences and chatting with whoever would speak to him. Eventually, he turned a ton of those conversations at a whole bunch of conferences into the New Energy Times, a website where he reports on developments in fusion. Since then, he's lectured at NASA and authored 3 books. And it was during the editing process for one of those books in 2014 that Stephen discovered something that sort of broke his brain.
I just stumbled on what I found here. It was an accident.
Stephen knew ITER had made a bold promise to produce 10 times the amount of energy it consumed. 10 times. Even though ITER was only a test reactor, which wouldn't achieve its goals until at least 2035, such a result would be a record-smashing number for fusion reactors compared to its predecessor, a test reactor called JET in the UK. That one couldn't even break even, meaning it produced less power than it consumed. ITER slapped this 10 times power gain claim all over its website and marketing materials.
800 cubic meters of burning plasma was to generate 500 megawatts of power, about 10 times as much as was needed to heat the plasma.
The number that describes the ratio of energy in, energy out, is called the Q ratio. Energy needed to heat the plasma inside the reactor versus energy generated by the resulting fusion reaction. But when Stephen needed to double check some figures for his book, he said a closer look at the Q ratio ITER promised revealed something concerning.
I assumed that everybody knew the rate of power that went into these reactors. But the scientists that I spoke to said, well, actually, we don't measure the rate of power that goes into the fusion reactors. And I'm going, what are you talking about? We all thought that the rate of power that you talk about was a comparison of the power coming out versus the power coming in. And they said, no, that power ratio doesn't compare the rate of power coming out versus the power coming in. It only compares the ratio of the power that's used to heat the fuel versus the thermal power that's produced by the fuel.
So it really only speaks to what happens deep inside the reactor when fusion happens, not the energy it takes to run the whole operation or the actual usable energy that could be produced. Stephen was confused.
And I'm thinking, wow, this is a pretty serious misunderstanding that I had, that everybody else that I know had.
As far as he knew, everybody had understood the ratio to mean 10 times more usable energy produced than it takes to run the entire reactor. So the first thing Stephen did was get in touch with the scientists at JET, the UK reactor that held the previous record for Q. He wanted to find out the ratio for total electrical power input versus total electrical power output had the reactor been connected to the grid.
The efficiency is 1%.
1%. Far from the 67% Stephen thought it was. That means if JET was hooked up to the grid, the reactor would lose almost all the power it used to operate.
My first reaction was, oh, there's a real serious discrepancy here.
So, what did all of this mean for ITER and its claim to have a Q ratio of 10? What did that really mean then? Everywhere the Q ratio was talked about, people seemed to understand it the same way Stephen had. Take a listen to these 2014 congressional hearings.
At this day and age, and now is the right time to build and operate experiments that can finally demonstrate that a man-made fusion system can consistently produce far more energy than it takes to fuel it. ITER is designed to produce at least 10 times the energy it consumes.
It is now possible to actually build a full-scale test reactor that produces far more energy than it uses.
Stephen says it was reported that way.
If you look at the 2017 New York Times story, if you look at news stories in Nature, Wall Street Journal, New Scientist, before all of these news outlets reported that the rate of power that ITER would require to operate was 50 megawatts.
50 megawatts in, 4,500 megawatts out. So will ITER actually produce 10 times more energy than it consumes? The answer depends on what you mean by energy.
Well, the queue is... One of the confusions on this factor is that there's really a Q physics, and to some degree, there's a Q engineering.
That's Mark Henderson again, the nuclear physicist who works at ITER. I asked him what this was all about and why there was confusion. He said physicists and non-physicists think of Q differently.
So for me to put in 50 megawatts of power, I need to pull from the grid about 150 megawatts. And so an engineer would say, well, Mark, wait a minute, you know, you're pulling 150 megawatts from the grid, you convert it to 50 megawatts, that gives me 500 megawatts out. But then those 500 megawatts are going to heat water that turns a turbine that then generates electricity that would put back to the grid roughly 150 megawatts. So from an engineer's perspective, if ITER was a fusion reactor, it would be giving a Q engineering roughly of about 1.
A Q physics ratio of 10, but a Q engineering ratio of 1. Not 10, 1. Mark even doubted if actual engineers who work on fusion sites correctly understood this difference, let alone the public. But it's an important difference nonetheless.
That means the ITER reactor is effectively a zero power reactor.
That's Stephen again.
If the design works as expected, we're going to get the same rate of power coming out as the power going in. Zero extra power that would be available to use for any practical purposes.
He notes that if ITER was hooked up to the grid, it would effectively be a massive, expensive, complicated, scientifically remarkable extension of electrical wire. But, of course, ITER was never going to be hooked up to the grid anyway. It's just a test reactor. So that in itself isn't a huge issue. To Stephen, the issue is one of misrepresentation. He argues ITER should have known Q physics was going to be misunderstood by the public. That language regarding power output and Q was always way too squishy for non-experts to reach any other conclusion than that Q and fusion power and output referred to usable energy rather than heated plasma, especially when those terms were so often cited in the context of virtually unlimited energy as a feasible solution to our impending climate crisis that deserved more funding. But Mark, the ITER physicist, argues if there was confusion, it was all just a misinterpretation. There was no purposeful misrepresentation.
It is very easy in any field to be misinterpreted. And unfortunately, it's easier for people to take pot shots at fusion just because the amount of invested money to build a machine, the longevity of building a machine, people will say, well, why are you building a fusion reactor compared to, for example, putting the money into a solar field or to a wind field? My answer is to say that, you know, we should be looking at a short-term objective and a long-term objective.
Still, though, on stage in Vienna in 2019 at a TED Talk entitled The Dawn of the Fusion Age, Mark did it himself. He cited the 10-time power gain without any further explanation of what it really meant.
At this point, we've decided to work together in a large environment where all nations are coming together, combining resources to build ITER. That's where I work. It's in the south of France. And our goal is to build a machine that performs 10 times better. So we have 1 watt going in equals 10 watts out.
There it is. 1 watt in equals 10 watts out. Technically true, But did the audience of non-physicists know he was talking about heating plasma and thermal power? Or did they assume he was talking about overall electrical power?
I don't like conveying information in a way that could be misinterpreted. And I think one of the key issues in communication is to be able to understand who your audience is and to convey that, give that audience enough information to be able to understand what this thing called capital Q is. So obviously fusion has hurt itself in how the Q, capital Q, has been interpreted in the community or in public.
Mark said a commercial fusion reactor will need a Q of about 40, four times the Q of ITER, to actually generate sufficient power to be viable. So why all the fuss about Q equals 10 from ITER? Michelle Claessens was the communications director for ITER for about 5 years and wrote a book about the project. He puts the whole Q thing pretty bluntly.
People just accepted this, and because it was, let's say, a good selling argument, voila. It went through the system.
Michelle said it took a while to correct the representation of Q on ITER's own website, and to him, it's still a bit vague. The current head of communications for ITER, Laban Koblenz, told me the organization does not believe there is any public misunderstanding of the Q ratio, nor does it believe its representation of Q was vague or incorrect. In the meantime, Stephen Krivet reached out to the organizations who had published the Q ratio without an explanation of what it meant. He's edited ITER Wikipedia pages to better explain Q, and personally emailed ITER member organizations from all over the world to get the number changed on their sites.
And the thing is, nobody has ever disagreed with me. All of these people that I contacted in these organizations, nobody's ever argued with me about the power values. Never.
That story was reported by Grant Hill. I want to tell you about a podcast I really like. It's called Trade-Offs with Dan Gorenstein, and it's about health policy. And this is the kind of stuff that matters to all of us. It impacts our health, our wallets, and what kind of access to care we will have. And I promise this is not a double-decker wonk sandwich. Trade-Offs unpacks these issues in a really accessible and fun way. You can check it out wherever you get your podcasts. This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about energy. We can't create energy, but we've learned how to store it so we can use it whenever we need it, no matter where we are. So many of the devices we use all day, every day, get their energy from batteries.
I'm just personally in awe of them and how they've transformed the way society uses energy.
Lynn Trahey is a material scientist at Argonne National Laboratory in Illinois.
You know, even my little kids, their early words are batteries, you know, because they know that batteries make things, make noises, and make pretty colors.
Batteries make the magic happen, but once again, it's not actual magic. It takes a lot of engineering to make it work, and batteries can become a bit of an Achilles heel in things that otherwise work great. Alan Yu has one such example.
When the Nissan Leaf came out about 10 years ago, it was the only mass-market electric car. Now, many Nissan Leaf owners want to replace one specific part.
It's the search for the Holy Grail, I think.
That's Mike Lawrence from Virginia talking about the battery in his family's silver Nissan Leaf. He and his wife Karen bought the car almost a decade ago.
And I absolutely fell in love with it.
They chose the car because they care about the environment. They say overall, the car has aged well.
It is not a pain in the neck because without a motor and the oil change, which we do not have to do because there ain't none, and, you know, other things, it rarely goes in for service beyond a checkup.
Everything except the battery.
the car, which started out with mileage occasionally even over 100, was deteriorating fairly quickly after we passed about the 5 or 6 year mark. We have been searching high and low for a new battery.
As a battery gets older, it degrades and stores less energy. And just like an old smartphone, it needs to be charged much more frequently. Now, Karen can only drive about 45 miles. They could buy a new battery from Nissan, but that would cost $8,000, more than the car is worth at this point.
We have, you know, joined the Facebook groups trying to learn about resources that we could find more palatable financially to do this.
There is a very active Facebook group dedicated to this battery. I talked to several Nissan Leaf owners, and they all have the same problem. They love the car, they just wish they could get a new battery for it that did not cost so much.
Really suits my needs for, you know, I don't feel like I'm driving a 10-year-old car at any time. About 2 years ago, as the winter approached, I knew that my Leaf was going to have a hard time, especially using heat and such in the wintertime, to get me to work, that I started the hunt looking for basically a replacement battery pack. That's the big problem, is it's very hard to source used high-capacity battery packs.
The one issue, though, being in Arizona and being that the Nissan Leaf, they don't have really a battery cooling, within 2 years, it got pretty heavy battery degradation.
Very common with a Leaf is that, you know, you'll replace the tires, you replace the windshield wipers, you replace the cabin air filter, and that's it. You know, they're indestructible, so people would like the batteries to last longer.
That was Tony Newell in Kentucky, John Ryan in Arizona, and Larry Kaplan in California. There is a whole gray market for these batteries. Some people buy wrecked Nissan Leafs, salvage the battery, and bring the rest of the car back to a junkyard. I asked Nissan for comment, and they could not schedule an interview. So how did we get to the point of an electric car battery being a problem in an otherwise great car? The first thing you should know is that the battery, which looks like a big silver rectangle, is typically the most expensive part of an electric car. It can cost as much as a third of the entire car. Electric cars use lithium-ion batteries, which is relatively recent technology compared to most other things in the car. Lithium-ion batteries won three scientists the 2019 Nobel Prize in Chemistry. On a very simple level, lithium-ion batteries work by lithium ions going back and forth in a liquid, in and out of the positive and negative ends of a battery. There is some liquid inside the batteries, but scientists say please do not cut open your batteries at home to confirm this. Lithium ions going one direction means charging the battery, storing energy. Going the other way means discharging the battery, converting the stored energy into electricity that you can use to power, say, a car. It's the same kind of battery that powers a smartphone or a laptop computer, but it is a lot more complicated than just taking a bunch of those batteries and putting them in a car. Gene Berdachevsky knows this very well, because that is exactly what he did.
Ripping out laptop cells, super gluing them together, putting some metal plates on the positive and negative side, and stuffing them in a car.
In the early 2000s, he was an undergrad at Stanford. At that time, most people did not really care about batteries.
Back in the early 2000s, batteries were regarded as uninteresting. They were an afterthought in many respects. You know, we think about the modern portable electronics industry, and we talk about it as being an industry that was revolutionized by semiconductors. You know, everything is about Intel and the microchip. And obviously, display technology played a really important role, 3G, 4G for cellular. But people sort of missed that the battery played just an equally important role.
As part of a class project, Gene realized with lithium-ion batteries getting cheaper, you could buy enough of them to build a car that could run for 300 miles on one charge and still make money selling the cars. Then he heard about a little startup doing exactly that. and became the seventh person to join this company called Tesla. There, they had to come up with better batteries for this new generation of cars. Super gluing laptop batteries together in the car did not work.
Every now and then, a manufacturing defect could cause a lithium-ion cell to spontaneously, more or less, go into thermal runaway. And that the frequency of those occurrences were about 1 in 1 million to 1 in 10 million cells at the time, is what we were told. But if you calculated the fact that each car had about 7,000 cells, it meant that one out of about 1,000 cars would at some point in its life spontaneously catch fire, which is an absolutely unacceptable. You know, we basically induced a failure in one of the cells in a small module we had built, a small prototype module, just to see what the event would look like in real life. And we did this late after hours in the parking lot, thinking we'll see a small fire. And what happened was these cells not only caught fire, but proceeded to launch themselves out of the module and fly 30, 40 feet in the air, like little rockets. And once we induced failure in one, it propagated to another, which propagated to two more and four more. And it became a little mini fireworks show, which was really the moment we said, okay, we got to solve this or there is no Tesla.
They stopped everything they were doing to fix this battery problem. It took them 6 months. Gene told me the non-trade secret version of what they did. They engineered around the problem to spread the heat around. They solved the problem in late 2005. And most likely, you already know that Tesla survived. Gene is still interested in batteries. He left Tesla to start his own company, Sila Nano, to advance battery technology even further. His company is working on a more powerful battery, along with the German car manufacturer Daimler, the company behind Mercedes-Benz. Battery technology is now worth a lot of money. More people want electric cars now, and California even announced a plan to stop selling new gas-powered cars by 2035, which means companies will have to make and sell a lot more lithium-ion batteries. Scientists who study batteries are also in demand because there are still many questions to answer.
The work I do on batteries, it's certainly something that's very accessible to my friends and family, and they now share all of their battery-related misadventures with me.
Julia Prager is a chemical engineer at Sandia National Laboratories, based in New Mexico.
I had a friend who told me about her experience working with a computer that had a bulging trackpad. And she worked on that computer with a bulging trackpad for months. And I'm assuming it was bulging because the battery had expanded so substantially. And to her, you know, it was not a cause of concern for months. Whereas when I heard that stutter, I thought, oh my gosh, I'm glad that she's okay.
That is bad. One thing that could happen is the expansion leads to a hole in the battery, which could lead to a fire. Her friend needed a new battery. Julia works on batteries as part of research on power grid level storage, how to store energy on a large scale. And one of the things she studies relates to the Nissan Leaf battery problem, the fact that these batteries degrade as they get older. To simplify things a lot, Julia explains the degradation can come from unwanted reactions that happen inside the battery and can produce gas. The gas can make some batteries expand, thus the bulging trackpad that Julia's friend saw. And that is just one of the ways that batteries can degrade over time.
There's a lot of research to minimize that, but it's avoiding entirely is just not possible.
So Julia is studying how long can people keep using a battery once they start degrading, which actually brings us back to the Nissan Leaf battery. Some Leaf owners have figured out that their old batteries might not hold enough charge to drive long distances, but they could use it as home energy storage in the future.
That technology is actually, in my opinion, really perfect for the Nissan Leaf.
Tony New in Kentucky wanted to replace a degrading Nissan Leaf battery, and he ended up buying 5 wrecked Nissan Leafs in his quest. He bought all those cars at a fraction of the cost of buying a new battery from Nissan directly. He says the Nissan Leaf comes with a charger that can go in both directions. It can store energy in the car battery, but it can also take the energy out to power something else.
I'm kind of holding onto those cars, even the older battery packs, thinking that one day there's going to be an interface that I can literally plug into my house and plug in my car. And with a solar panel, you know, I could be charging those batteries up. And then when I needed power and there's no sun or it's cold out or whichever, you know, those cars provide all my energy and you would be totally self-sufficient.
It's not as much of a dream as one might think. Tesla makes a giant battery designed for homes called a Powerwall. One of those stores a fraction of the energy that Tony's collection of wrecked Nissan Leaf batteries can store, and costs a lot more. There's a mechanical engineer in Arizona who made a business out of this. He salvages old Nissan Leaf batteries, charges them with solar panels, and uses them as a power source for people who live in vans and RVs. Nissan itself partners with a commercial energy storage company to repurpose and reuse old Leaf batteries.
That was Alan Yu reporting. Most of us have a battery in our pockets, in our phones, but hundreds of thousands of people carry a similar battery inside of their bodies, in medical devices. So the stakes are high.
Failure is just not an option, right? Mm-hmm. Unacceptable. Which is very different than, you know, if we buy a battery for, you know, a child's toy or a battery for, you know, the remote control on our TV. You know, if the battery runs down, we might be annoyed.
That's Esther Takeuchi. She is a professor at Stony Brook University, and she's been working on medical batteries since the 80s. These batteries are in pacemakers for arrhythmia or implantable cardiac defibrillators. And these devices go into a person's chest. They are not very big, and the battery has to be therefore smaller yet, right?
Yes, correct.
So how big are we talking?
The pacemaker is quite small. One way to envision it is if we envision silver dollars and maybe stacked 2 or 3 of them together, that would be the size of the entire device. And then the battery, as you said, is smaller than the device itself because the device also contains some circuitry.
Now, that's smaller than the battery that's in my phone, which I have to charge at least once a day. So how do you get this thing to last?
For the pacemaker, one of the advantages is that the amount of current that the pacemaker uses is very small. The job of the pacemaker is to deliver a very small amount of current to the heart just to remind the heart to beat.
The cardiac defibrillator has to deliver a high-energy shock to the patient's heart. Esther says it uses about 1 million times more energy than a pacemaker. Hopefully, for most patients, they won't need that intervention very often, but it still means that it needs a more powerful battery, which means the device is bigger.
It's definitely smaller than a hockey puck, but not quite as small as a pacemaker.
Esther actually helped develop the cardiac defibrillator battery that is in use today. It uses lithium metal,
which has very high energy content. And in fact, it provides the highest voltage and the highest energy content of any metal, of any element.
And silver, because that's very electrically conductive.
So by having a very conductive material, we're able to make sure that the current that we need coming out of the battery is very high.
So everything to pack a lot of punch in a small package. And is there a quest to make these batteries smaller and stronger and smaller and stronger?
I would say that that quest is not limited to medical batteries. You know, so much of our lives these days, you know, from all of our portable electronics, you know, cell phones, laptops, you know, iPads, everything that we carry around with us. Of course, we want longer life and smaller batteries. Can we put more energy into a given volume, make it smaller, make it lighter weight, and pack more energy in?
And there are extra precautions that have to be taken because these batteries are inside of a human body.
The medical batteries use something called a glass to metal seal, where there's glass, very specialized glass, that is used to isolate the positive and negative terminals of the battery and seal the internal contents such that no leakage is possible. So there's no liquid that can come out, there's no gas that can come out, there's no gas that can go in. And I should say that in addition to that, the battery is enclosed, fully enclosed in the device, and the device itself is in a titanium housing. So we have a stainless steel housing inside a titanium housing. So there's kind of a dual level of protection to make sure that nothing is coming out of the battery and equally nothing is going into the battery to damage the battery.
It sounds like a safe inside of a safe inside of a safe, yeah.
That's a very good analogy, safe inside of a safe.
Esther says more and more medical devices are coming out that need batteries, and that poses new design challenges.
I believe there is. Interestingly, on the medical battery front, devices that are becoming more commonly used are for an additional form of therapy called neurostimulation, where there might be a lead that is attached somehow to a nerve someplace in your body, and it provides stimulation to a nerve or sometimes even to the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And what these devices can do is control a variety of things. They can sometimes control epilepsy or tremor. They've been explored for treatment of totally unmanageable depression, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So for those types of applications, the devices often use a rechargeable battery where the battery can be recharged even under the skin.
And there's no port coming out, right? It's not like you're plugging in a cell phone. It's more like you're setting the phone on top of one of those saucer type deals,
and then exactly. So imagine, you know, it's things like setting the phone on a pad, or, you know, imagine an electric toothbrush, you know, where it's really not connected to a wire. You just mm-hmm. kind of put it in its stand and it recharges, and that's what it's able to do. The energy can be transmitted directly through the skin. And then that way, the patient can use this device and battery for a long time because they keep recharging the battery.
Esther Takeuchi is a professor in the Department of Chemistry and Material Science Engineering at Stony Brook University in New York. Coming up, a look at the laws of energy and the greater lessons they hold.
Just how wonderful it is that you have these kinds of physical laws, because it seems that it might be fundamental for allowing life itself to emerge.
That's next on The Pulse.
Support for The Pulse comes from Select Greater Philadelphia. With over 30 cell and gene therapy development companies, Greater Philadelphia is where the field started and continues to thrive. More at discoverystartshere.com. The Commonwealth Fund supports The Pulse and reporting on health equity. The Commonwealth Fund, affordable quality healthcare for everyone.
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about energy. And throughout the show, we've been hearing from Clifford Johnson. He's a professor in the physics and astronomy department at the University of Southern California. Energy can neither be created nor destroyed, but in many ways, once it's used, it becomes inaccessible to us. So it's still out there, but we can't get it back.
Frustratingly, although energy is conserved, you can't always get at it. That sort of irreversibility is something that we all intuitively have a good idea about from everyday life and is a real quantifiable thing in physics.
You know, it's intuitive because you observe it. And I'm thinking even early humans must have understood this concept to some degree because you make a fire and then your wood is gone. Or, you know, you have food and then you eat it and that is gone. You know, so I think instinctively it makes sense to us.
Yeah. And, you know, I think it speaks to bigger themes of finiteness of resources, of finiteness of life even. And I think it really resonates with us from our everyday experience. And yes, I think goes back in some ways to what must have been with us as soon as we began to appreciate how the world works, a sort of sadness in a way about how the world works in some ways.
And even the things that we think are here forever, you know, I was thinking about the power of the sun or all of these things are still finite.
Yes, definitely. The sun, which seems like an infinite source of energy, is a very finite source of energy. On the scale of energy that we care about, you know, in order to make our cups of tea and so on and so forth, the sun, yeah, it does seem like an infinite energy source. But indeed, if we wait long enough, the sun will run out of energy. And indeed, the universe at large seems to be finite. It has a finite lifetime. And so really nothing seems to go on forever.
And if you try to envision the other possibility, like if it were possible to set things in motion and they wouldn't stop, that could also be terrifying real quick.
Yes.
Depending on what you send in motion.
Indeed, yeah. And in some ways, I think on the one hand, it seems like, oh, it's a shame the universe works this way and what have you. But on the other hand, as you say, in a way, maybe it's a good thing the universe works this way. And in fact, there's one perspective where it's sort of sad that it works this way, another perspective where it's actually quite beautiful how it all fits together. And I think we've been appreciating a lot in science, not just physics, but in related fields, all the way out to biology and the study of life, just how wonderful it is that you have these kinds of physical laws, because it seems that it might be fundamental for allowing life itself to emerge and then to make sense. Life, in some ways, can be defined as at least a temporary way of beating some of this temporarily in the sense that you have this sort of disorganized, messy system where just it's all random and chaotic seeming. And then something very organized comes out of it and has ways of taking things in and producing structure and order and, you know, doing the things that we know life does, at least for a while. And so it's kind of this wonderful feeling of hope in the sense that there is a way, despite the fact that the universe fundamentally tells you that all this energy is sort of dissipating away in a way that becomes inaccessible for doing work, there is this system called life that somehow can temporarily grab hold of some of that stuff and reverse that process, at least for a while, and build wonderful art and culture and cities and language and all the things that we do, which is certainly using energy to produce structure, which is sort of the opposite of dissipation.
Clifford Johnson is a professor in the Physics and Astronomy Department at the University of Southern California. Check out his graphic novel about science called The Dialogues, Conversations about the Nature of the Universe. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. You can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, and Jad Slayman. Sojourner Ahebe is our health equity fellow. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Xavier Lopez is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral Health Reporting on the Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's Health and Science Reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.